Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm speaking today with Sona Demijian, PhD. Sona is the director of the Rene Crown Wellness Institute and professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Her research focuses on cultivating mental health and well-being among women, children, and families by engaging people's capacities for learning to care for themselves and their communities. She develops and studies programs and practices in education and healthcare settings, with an emphasis on navigating key developmental transitions, such as the perinatal period, early childhood, and adolescence. Current projects in Sona's lab focus on preventing depression and supporting well-being among new and expectant mothers, promoting healthy body image and leadership among young women, and enhancing mindfulness and compassion among youth, families, and educators. In 2019, Sona co-authored Expecting Mindfully, Nourish Your Emotional Well-Being and Prevent Depression During Pregnancy and Postpartum, to which I contributed. Welcome to the Metta Hour, Sona.
Thank you so much, Sharon. It's really an honor to be here with you.
It's really delightful to talk to. So congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
And I thought it would be nice to just begin our conversation with a little bit of your story, how you came to practice, how you came to your path.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I was thinking, actually, as you were reading that introduction about the importance of transitions in people's lives. And I think my first experience of meditation was high school. And actually, in part for my dad, who had a long time meditation practice himself. And I think it was really, you know, speaking of times of transition, it was awareness of, you know, this incredible period of inner and outer transition that characterizes adolescence for most people, I think, and really wanting to find some solid ground in the midst of all of that. And I'm not sure I would say that, you know, the practice of meditation necessarily provides solid ground, but I think it helped me discover this capacity within myself to have a place to rest, you know, to actually embrace in a way that was welcoming of all the change that was around me. So that was really my first introduction to meditation, which seems like a million years ago at this point. And then I would say I went to college at the University of Chicago, which is a very, you know, heady and intellectual academic place, and was really, which I loved. And during that time, I think I steered away in some ways from personal practice and really, you know, delved into a much more, you know, scholarly and scientific approach to similar kinds of interests and questions, but much less with an emphasis on personal practice. And it wasn't actually, I would say, until I was in graduate school, at the end of my second year of graduate school, my graduate advisor, with whom I had worked very closely, died suddenly of a heart attack. And that was a really difficult experience for myself, the other people in our lab, his family. It was so, you know, just there was so much shock and grief that followed that. And I think at that time, there was something that pulled me back to those early experiences of meditation and some kind of knowingness that had been planted, you know, much earlier in life. And I renewed a daily practice at that point with much more focus and clarity, I would say, and also, you know, was as a clinical psychology PhD student, really seeking a way to integrate that personal practice of mindfulness with the scholarly and empirical academic work that I was doing. So I would say, you know, in some sense, that was a really formative period for the research and clinical practice that I've done, you know, since that time, which is, it is 20 years ago this year that my advisor passed away. Mm.
Well, that is extremely intense. And it's interesting that you had something to reach for,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was somewhat in your past, but was still in many ways still present.
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, the practice of meditation is one that I think people often turn to in times of struggle or suffering. And it's the exact, your reflection about having something to turn to during difficult times, I would say has actually been, it's been a guiding force for me in the research that I do, because it really has been oriented to in what ways can we help provide opportunities for people to learn
mm-hmm.
when things, you know, maybe going relatively well, that will help them build knowledge and skill that is then there and available to them when times are more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a, it's a really critical perspective. I think it's a way in which, you know, the clinical science and meditation practice have really converged in some really interesting and productive ways.
So in your new book, which came out earlier in 2019, Expecting Mindfully, Nourish Your Emotional Well-Being and Prevent Depression During Pregnancy mm-hmm. and Postpartum, was the population it was intended for people who might be seen as susceptible to depression or people who were actively depressed during their pregnancy and postpartum?
It's a great question. So that book it comes out of research that we've done that has really focused on this question of, for women who have had some personal experience with depression, and this can be at any point in their life. So it doesn't necessarily have to have been, you know, a previous pregnancy or in early parenting, mm-hmm. you know, are at increased risk of struggling with depression during the perinatal period. So we were really interested in asking, you know, this kind of same question that grows out of your reflection, which is, if you know that by virtue of having been depressed in the past, that you carry an increased risk of having a relapse of depression during pregnancy and postpartum, what is it that one can do to help protect oneself from depression coming back during this life cycle phase? And that really, that's been the guiding question and is really the focus of that book. You know, women who have some vulnerability mm-hmm. to depression, to responding to stressors, or even to times of uncertainty with challenges with mood or with anxiety.
Well, it's such an important topic, and it's one that's still surrounded by a fair amount of stigma and misunderstanding. Do you think that it's getting, like postpartum depression, is getting significantly more prevalent, or do you think it's just kind of the same?
You know, there are more and more people who are willing to speak out and speak up, I think, about their experience of depression, experience of mental health struggles in general, and there is still a tremendous amount of stigma mm-hmm. that people experience in general, and I think in particular during this life cycle phase. I think we still, you know, carry as a culture this idea that pregnancy and becoming a parent are, you know, quote, should be the happiest times mm-hmm. in a woman's life. And you know, that is informed by, you know, just decades of really stereotypes, more so than science, about what are the normative experiences of women in general, as well as women who may be more vulnerable to depression during these times. So while I think there's increased attention, and, you know, there are a number of individuals as well as advocacy groups like Postpartum Support International that have, you know, worked for years to really combat stigma associated with depression during pregnancy and early parenting, I still think there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And that is both the inner work of embracing and really allowing space for one's own challenges and vulnerability. And it's the outer work of being willing to have these conversations in places that, you know, people may not have in the past, being willing to both ask for help as well as, I think, you know, for those of us who are in teaching and helping and scientific professions and disciplines, really being willing to put an emphasis on how do we share the skills and knowledge that we've developed in ways that will be more accessible for people in daily life.
Well, it certainly seems that there may be specific needs in that community of moms or moms-to-be that are perhaps not being met in the more general offerings of meditation and mindfulness these days in our culture, even as mindfulness gets more and more widespread.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, as we were discussing earlier, turn to mindfulness or meditation as a source of support and a source of healing. And while that can be the case for many people, I do think that there are ways in which a specific focus on what is the nature of mind, really, for people who are vulnerable to depression, that specificity has value and it has power in people's lives. And the work that I have done in this area in collaboration with my colleague and friend Cheryl Goodman has really been grounded in this approach of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which was developed by another dear friend and collaborator, Zindel Siegel, as well as Mark Williams and John Teasdale. And that approach really seeks to bring the wisdom that exists in the tradition of mindfulness meditation and the theoretical and empirical knowledge that exists in cognitive therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, and to integrate those in a way that, you know, I think in some sense, like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts mm-hmm. with that approach, because it brings both the power of mindfulness meditation and the specificity of a focus on where do people get stuck mm-hmm. Who are vulnerable to depression, and what are some really specific ways that we can engage mindfulness to help provide freedom from those stuck points.
Well, isn't it the case, I'm certainly not a scientist, but that the research shows that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is a pretty effective remedy for dealing with depression.
Particularly effective for helping people to prevent relapse into future episodes of depression. Mm-hmm. So in the research we've done with women during pregnancy, women who did an 8-week mindfulness-based cognitive therapy class were protected from relapse into depression, 85% of women, in contrast to only 50% of women who received, you know, usual care within a large HMO setting. And so that's a substantial and, you know, statistically and clinically significant difference, and really speaks to the ability of an 8-week class, essentially 8 weeks, you know, 2 hours a week, as well as daily practice, in providing a context for learning skills that help women stay protected from depression during pregnancy through 6 months postpartum. So those are pretty compelling data. And then when we look to the research in the general population, we can see the enduring benefit of these experiences and this learning, you know, up to 2 years of studies of up to 2-year follow-up periods in people's lives, which tells us, from, you know, using some of the most rigorous scientific methods and comparisons, that learning these skills provides protection long after people are done taking these 8-week classes. And to me, that says something about the transformative power of this learning in people's lives.
How did you recruit the women for the study?
We shared information. A lot of the research that we have published to date has been within the Kaiser system, both in Colorado as well as in Georgia. And we basically shared information in the context of prenatal care clinics and are you interested in learning about how to stay well? And how to protect your mental health during pregnancy and the postpartum. We're doing a study now that actually is a national study that's in partnership with Mass General Hospital as well as Baby Center, which is a large online community of pregnant and parenting people. And in that study, we're recruiting pregnant women from all over the country who will either go through the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy course in a form that we developed to be delivered entirely online. So they can have these training experiences, you know, from the comfort of their own living rooms really all over the country. And we're really interested in understanding if we increase access to these skills and to this training, to what extent will that help protect women's mental health?
And I'm curious if there was a partner involved in mm-hmm. in the family configuration, did you involve them as well?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one of the things that we know from research on the ways in which people are vulnerable during pregnancy and early parenting and, you know, really throughout our lives is when we lack a supportive community and when we lack people who support us in our efforts to be well. And so one of the very first experiences in both the book that we wrote and the classes that we teach is to actually map out who are the people in your life who are close to you and who support you. So if we were working together in this way, we would, you know, kind of draw a picture with you, in the center and then begin to talk about who are the people in your life and how close and how available or how distant are they. And then from that sense of the ecosystem of your life, to identify a person, and it could be the other parent in the family system, it could be a friend, a neighbor, another relative, it could be someone next door or someone across the country, but someone who is willing to support you in your process of learning, in your daily practice, and to really be a champion for women during pregnancy and early parenting in both learning these skills as well as taking the steps that are needed to look after themselves during this transition period.
Well, I'm sure it's really tough in part because there's such a myth about the mother, you know, who has it all together. I mean, I can remember listening to somebody, she was giving a lecture about something, and she said when her second child was born, she went into this period of just like this tremendous anguish and comparing herself to her mother, who was always like well-groomed and the house was immaculate and her house was in complete disarray and she felt like she looked a mess. And then she remembered, oh, her mother had a maid, you know, and she didn't.
Right. And even if we don't have those examples in our personal lives, they are all over the place in the media and movies. And they're in our kind of cultural, you know, psyche of expectations of what we, the standards to which mothers hold themselves. And so one of the things, one of the activities that we guide in the class and in the book is actually to articulate, to look closely at what are some of these myths around motherhood. And they are statements like, it's not okay to ask for help. I should be able to do all of this. You know, my job is to care for other people. I can look after myself only after I've taken care of everyone else. Asking for help is a sign of weakness. And so one of the goals of this program is actually to develop this skill that as researchers and psychologists, we often describe as the skill of decentering, which is this capacity that is such a core part of mindfulness meditation. It is this capacity to notice thoughts as they arise without getting hijacked by them, without getting sucked into them, without getting pulled off center by them. And so to notice thoughts as they arise in a space of wider awareness. And so for women during pregnancy or for people in early parenting, it's often these sorts of, as you said, myths that are about the whether or not it's okay to rely on other people. And so to begin to notice those as just that, as thoughts that arise and ones that we can become curious about rather than automatically reacting to. So noticing in a moment of feeling overwhelmed, this thought, there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has it together. Everyone else can handle this. There's something wrong with me that I am overwhelmed in this moment, and to notice that as a thought in a greater field of awareness and to get curious about that, well, you know, rather than having that thought have the capacity or the power to really knock you off center.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the process of connection and mothers connecting with the baby and how the states of disconnect that often accompany depression can affect a mother's ability to bond with her child. And I can remember when we were working on the meditations together,
that
and you would suggest things like, you know, feel the weight of the baby in your arms, and now smell your baby. And I'd say, really?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You sure? But we went with it, you know.
We did. And, you know, it's a beloved meditation practice by many of the women with whom we work. Because here's the thing that often happens is that when women during pregnancy or early parenting, when they hear about mindfulness and they may begin taking a class or reading the book that we wrote, that sometimes what can happen is that mindfulness practice itself becomes incorporated into that system of self-judgment, mm-hmm. expectations, criticisms, and these standards to which we measure ourselves and often fail.
Mm-hmm.
And so mindfulness practice becomes like one more thing that I have to do in order to be a quote good mom.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who are taking care of kids and working and have so many demands on their time and their lives, the expectation that they will also add to that to meditate 45 minutes a day can itself be another way in which they're failing. So what I think women really love about that practice of mindfully holding your baby, mindfully walking with your baby is this invitation to bring these skills of awareness and curiosity and non-judgment into these everyday moments that themselves provide an opportunity to practice without having to add, you know, another item on your to-do list. And so the ability to bring mindfulness into everyday life is such a beautiful synergy of how to care for yourself and how to care for your child at the same time.
It seems like there used to be much more clear-cut roles in parenting based on cultural norms, which are kind of in disarray, or at least change. And in 2019, there's just about every permutation of what it means to be a parent and what it means to be a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how this reflects on the emotional challenges of parenting.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, I think that one of the benefits of mindfulness practice and one of the areas that we focus a lot in the book is on the vulnerability that I think can be created by comparing mind.
Mm-hmm.
So comparing oneself to some standard, whether or not it's a standard that, you know, you confront in the culture around you or one that, you know, that you carry around internally, even implicitly, the training the skill to notice when that comparing mind is present,
mm-hmm.
and again to become curious about that, to notice it and to let it go when it's not helpful or supportive for you, I think is a really critical skill when, you know, when we are all living in a time of, you know, a lot of change and uncertainty. So I think families today for across the board, whatever the structure or form and however we define family, we all are living in a time of increased uncertainty and I would say increased challenge and decreased support, really, that's available. I think, live in a culture right now that does not prioritize or value in really substantial ways the act of caring. And so whether or not your family is a family of, you know, caring for a baby or young children, or a family of caring for a loved one with whom you're connected in whatever form, caring for parents or relatives, you know, caring for your extended community or neighborhood, that those acts of caring, I think, structurally, our culture right now really deprioritizes, and I would say in some pretty practical ways, devalues those facets of our lives. And so I think, you know, that's a challenge that we all face, which is to really embrace and value the importance of caring, you know, not only for ourselves, but caring for one another. And, you know, that impacts all of us in whatever structure or whatever ways we define what family is.
One of the really beautiful things about so many different forms of what we call families or recognize as families is that all those sort of like little secret things are out in the open, you know? Like people just say, oh, right, that's part of life, you know, that a family can look like this or a family can look like that. And I'm curious as to whether, because I'm close to several families where the family was created through adoption, if there's been research that either you've done or that you know about that kind of family coming together.
You know, one of the things we've been working on, and this relates to both the work that we're doing during adolescence, as well as, you know, the work we're moving into in terms of pregnancy and early parenting, is really thinking more critically about the role of gender and how we think about gender. And so beginning to become, I think, more conscious even in our languaging so that we, you know, can, you know, in some ways, I think it's important and valuable to speak about the specific experiences of people who identify as women. And in other ways, I think it's really helpful to move into less gendered language and talk about pregnant people and people who are parenting, and to begin to hold a more inclusive lens for thinking about mental health and these life transitions. And that's been really critical in our work with adolescents, and increasingly so in the way we think about pregnancy and early parenting.
So one of my questions was going to be about what's next in the world of your research. So you talked about the national study, and then there's this part, which is very, very interesting, about more inclusive language and recognizing the world as it is.
Yes. Exactly. You know, one, in thinking about having this conversation together today, Sharon, I recalled a moment. I must have been, I don't know, maybe even definitely more than 10 years ago, of a day of practice that I had the opportunity to do that you led at the Garrison Institute. And maybe even 15 years ago at this point. And it was, you guided a loving kindness practice, a sitting practice. And then you invited all of us to go out and to do a loving kindness walking practice. And in that practice was this opportunity to kind of, as I recall, and you can amend this, if this is inconsistent with your memory of the teaching, but as I recall, it was this practice where we walked outside, and it's this beautiful, you know, setting, and to share this love and kindness with whatever creatures or plants or people one came into contact with as they were walking. Do you recollect from this practice? So this was a time when I think I was actually transitioning from being a graduate student at the University of Washington to moving and taking this as a, you know, first faculty position at the University of Colorado Boulder here. And I, at that time, was feeling, a sense of loneliness and also this sense of, like, I was leaving behind these people who had been really important teachers. And this sense of moving into this phase of life when I was intended to become the teacher, mm-hmm. as opposed to having all these teachers and mentors on whom I had relied. And as I walked around doing this loving kindness practice, sharing loving kindness with a blade of grass, with a butterfly, with a tree, it was this moment of realization that there actually are all these teachers all around us all the time, and seeing these really beautiful teachings that existed right there in front of me, just in our natural world, the way a butterfly can land with so much grace and beauty in a moment and have a moment of pure stillness and then be off in flight. You know, the way in which, you know, a car can, without awareness, sort of trample, you know, the grass. And yet, like, there's still blades of grass that rise from, you know, that weight that mm-hmm. was on them. And so really, like, in that experience, realizing that there are teachers and there is expertise and wisdom all around us. Now, I share that with you because that experience was a really eye-opening for me, and I think established an important foundation in a kind of humility about what is a teacher or who is a teacher and who is a student, mm-hmm. and where teaching resides in our world. So one of the aspects of the work that I and my colleagues are doing right now that is so exciting and really enlivening and gives me so much hope and optimism and in the world in general right now is through the Crown Institute that has really is really emphasizing in our work the importance of participatory approaches to research. And so what that means is that we are structuring research teams to include not just people like myself who have expertise from graduate training and, you know, the kind of scholarly backgrounds that we bring. We see that kind of knowledge and expertise as important and also as really partial. So I'll give you one example. We spent the day today, my colleague Zindel Siegel and I, he was here visiting from Toronto, with a project that we have right now called Mindful Campus that includes eight undergraduate students. That includes a number of graduate students, staff from the Division of Student Affairs on our campus, staff and campus leaders in academic advising, faculty from the School of Education, from the Department of Religious Studies, from psychology and neuroscience, all working together with a shared understanding that we are all students and we are all teachers, that we all have expertise to bring to this question of how can we together collaboratively design a mindfulness program that will address the needs of students on our campus and the culture and climate that exists here. And that kind of research undertaking, I draw the kind of kernel of valuing learning from all of these different sources. The seed of that actually goes back to some of those early meditation practices, mm-hmm. and that early mindful and loving kindness walking practice of recognizing, seeing the wisdom that is around each of us and finding ways to open our eyes to that and to create a platform for people to be active partners in this work of developing and studying new and transformative ways of bringing these practices into people's lives.
Well, that's really beautiful. And I'm wondering, we have just a few minutes if you want to lead a short practice.
I would love to lead a short practice. I would love to lead actually a very brief practice that, speaking of new areas of work and research, is comes from my, as a core practice in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and is the practice of the 3-minute breathing space.
Mm-hmm.
And this practice is one that another area of work right now that is really central to a collaboration between myself and Zindel Siegel that really is focused on how do we increase access and make these practices more available to people in daily life. This 3-minute breathing space has proven to be such a central part of what has been of benefit for people from the broader mindfulness-based cognitive therapy mm-hmm. program. In part because it is this way of weaving mindfulness into both everyday moments of our lives as well as it's a support that's available to us when times are challenging and difficult. So I'd love to share it with
great.
You. So the first, the beginning of this practice, in part because it is such a brief practice, is to bring an intentional posture that is both alert, so signaling from the body to the brain a sense of alertness and awakeness, and also has a quality of ease and relaxation. So allowing your posture, whether you're sitting or standing in this moment, to be upright, and at the same time, noticing any extra tension or tightness or holding. For some of us, it may be in the jaw or the neck or the shoulders. And just allow, as best you can, tension to almost drain from those parts of the body to bring a sense of ease. If it's helpful, you may close your eyes or allow your gaze to rest on a single point just before you. So this practice involves 3 steps, and we'll begin with simply becoming aware of what is in our experience right here in this moment, noticing thoughts that may be present in the mind, noticing emotions, and perhaps briefly scanning the body, noticing, simply becoming aware and acknowledging sensations that may be present in the body. Allowing and acknowledging whatever is in your field of awareness right now, pleasant or unpleasant, simply opening and asking, what is my experience right now? And then when you're ready, in the second step, we invite awareness to gather at the sensations of breathing at the belly, focusing moment by moment on the sensations of breathing in and breathing out. As best you can, bring your awareness again and again to the pattern of movement at the belly, allowing the breath to be an anchor for your awareness. Simply feeling, breathing in, and breathing out. And now in the third step, inviting awareness to expand from the belly, including not only the breath, but a sense of the body as a whole. Allowing awareness to be spacious, holding your full experience in this expanded awareness. Breathing, sitting or standing. Allowing awareness to be open and wide. And then when you're ready, allowing your eyes to open, and as best you can, bringing this expanded, more spacious, and anchored awareness to the next moments of your day.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for speaking with me today. If you'd like to learn more about Sona's work, you can check out her website at www.colorado.edu/wellnessinstitute. Thanks to all you listeners. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be happy.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.